spoon size matters, smoking and diabetes risk, autism clusters, and we're going to review some tips on patient education. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. We are now into our second week of 2010. And if you haven't already figured this out, I'm Jimmy Davis, the pod medic, your host here at The Nursing Show. And I'd like to welcome everybody to the show. If you haven't already done so, remember you can go over to nursingshow.com. You'll find episode show notes for this and every other episode of The Nursing Show, as well as other articles, information, study aids for nursing students, and a whole lot more over there, as well as ways to sign up to become a member of our Nursing Show newsletter and get all of the show notes links sent to you every week. You'll find all of that over at nursingshow.com. I also urge you, while you're over there, to leave comments. If you see an article there you'd like to leave a comment on, you can just click on the comments link. There's a little button bubble right there at the top of each article, and also at the bottom, you can click on that link, leave a comment, and share your thoughts with the other visitors and readers at the Nursing Show site. Of course, you can also always reach me by email. Send comments into The Nursing Show to comments@nursingshow.com. I love to hear from you, and it's important because this is a community effort, and it's important for me to hear from you what news articles and items you'd like to hear or see in future episodes, what tips you'd like me to review, and especially if there are any corrections that need to be made. We want to make sure that the best possible information is presented to you here on The Nursing Show. Let's move right on into this week's news items, and I wanted to lead off with a story I found at WebMD.com. Spoon size leads to medication dosing errors. We've talked about the issues with med dosing errors in the past, and one of the problems isn't something directly associated with nursing care, but it is a patient education issue, and as you get through this particular episode, and especially the news items, you're going to realize we're going to be focusing on patient education throughout this episode, not just the tip of the week, but all three news items have to do with patient education in one way or another. And this is important, especially important, because we so often send our patients home, pediatric patients and adult patients, and we may have told them that part of their education is to use an over-the-counter medication, a cough medication or a pain relief medication, and it may be available in a liquid form. And if the patient doesn't use an appropriate measuring device to measure that liquid, then they're going to certainly get an improper dose, either too much or too little to treat their problem, which will lead them to take more if it's too little and may overdose them if it's too much. And this is especially dangerous for pediatric patients. Pediatric patients are especially at risk because, of course, other people are giving them their medication, so they don't have a lot of control over what gets taken in. And if parents are using a piece of their kitchen flatware as a measuring spoon, there's no way to know what the depth and volume of that spoon contains. Whether it's a soup spoon or a so-called teaspoon, that teaspoon is not a measuring version of the teaspoon. So we need to educate our patients to use appropriate measurement devices. You know, the little graduated spoons that you can get at a drugstore, they're not that expensive, and it may be worthwhile to talk to your facility or talk to your boss about having some of those on hand. They cost a few cents in bulk, and you can just give one to your patients of young children, parents of young children that can have that measuring device and say, this is what you should use. You should never use a kitchen implement to measure. And have those, show them how they're measured. Pour some water into it and show them how to read it. This is something that we should send our patients out with the proper educational information, and this is just part of it. And this particular study shows that the people that were measuring using a kitchen spoon were often underdosed or overdosed. 8.4% patients were underdosed using spoons, and 11.6 were overdosed using spoons in the kitchen rather than a regular measurement device. And this is a significant problem, especially when you look at some of the medications that are being given. Many of these meds contain acetaminophen, which can be very dangerous in large doses. And if patients aren't measuring carefully or understanding carefully what they're doing, they can quickly overdose a pediatric patient on acetaminophen if they're not understanding what it is that they're doing. So this is something that falls into our bailiwick, if you will, as nurse educators, and we need to be working with our patients to make sure they have the proper tools as well and how to recognize and acquire those tools if they need assistance doing so. So I just urge you to follow up. There's a great bit of information in this article, and you can find that link in the show notes over at nursingshow.com. Next up is a study I found over at CNN Health, and it's been related in a couple of other locations as well. But patients who are quitting smoking, and a lot of people have made resolutions to lose weight, quit smoking, whatever it might be this time of year, we often find that there are side effects to some of those things that they're doing. They lose weight, but they don't do it safely. They lose some weight and then rebound beyond that as they have that rebound weight gain. And quitting smoking has side effects associated with it, including weight gain. One of the things a new study found was that, yes, it's important to quit smoking, but that they're, because of the concurrent weight gain, some of these patients then put themselves at greater risk for developing type 2 diabetes. Geez, how do we go about dealing with this issue? A lot of patients are going to read this particular article at CNN.com, and they're going to say, see, I shouldn't quit smoking. I could get diabetes. And obviously, we don't want to have that happen. So how do we deal with this? Well, I think it goes along with helping them to find the right tools to accomplish their healthcare goals. And it means that we need to talk to them about what their goals are. And that's a part of any patient education process, is assessing what the healthcare goals are and then helping them to have the tools and the resources necessary to reach those goals. Yes, they should be quitting smoking, but they may need to also evaluate other aspects of their lives. And if they are worried about gaining weight because they quit smoking, then part of quitting smoking should include a look at their nutritional plan and their dietary concerns and helping them to understand what to do to alleviate that. And there are a lot of things they can do so that they also understand that quitting smoking is very, very important for their health, and that they should also understand that this doesn't mean they're automatically going to be getting diabetes, and that that's an excuse not to quit smoking. Certainly, we need to address all these issues, and we educate our patients about how to read news articles like this carefully, because a lot of people will look at the headline and use it as an excuse not to get healthier, and we need to educate our patients appropriately. Finally, my last item in the news has to do with a look at autism spectrum disorders. This is a hot button issue, a hot topic with a lot of parents and a lot of bad knowledge out there on the internet and in the news about what causes autism, how patients can avoid autism. And one of those things has been this understanding that there must be some environmental cause of autism because of so-called autism clusters. We've looked at clusters in other areas, cancer clusters and things like that. And California actually instituted a study to look at the prevalence of autism in the state, and is there actually a presence of so-called autism clusters? And if there is some pollutant at fault, what is that pollutant? Well, the study went to look for a smoking gun, and they found that there really isn't one. They looked at 2.4 million birth records that included 10,000 autism cases, children diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder in the state of California. And they found that there really aren't autism clusters, that in fact they can account for the so-called autism clusters because of localized either autism in the news, autism education programs, either at the community level or for healthcare providers. You know, if you have an active program or if you have an educational institution in your community that is there to reach out to medical professionals and educate them on how to recognize autism spectrum disorder, guess what? You're going to have more diagnoses of autism spectrum disorder. The same thing for parents. If there's more awareness in the news, in the community, in the healthcare system for autism spectrum disorder, the parents are going to be more aware of watching for signs, and they may go and reach out for assistance and resources for their children and have that child, again, be more likely to be diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder than they might be in an area with less educational resources for the medical system or the parents themselves. So that's what this particular thing found. And I think it's important for us to understand this and to educate our patients about how to read articles critically, how to understand what good research is versus bad research or no research, as so often is the case with a lot of internet medical knowledge. And we're going to look at that more in depth as we dig into good patient education here coming up in the tip of the week. You can find links again to all of these news articles in the show notes. And again, it's important for you to follow up on this information because I really only hit the high points here in the news segments here at The Nursing Show. Time for the tip of the week. And as I said earlier, this week's tip is going to be looking at patient education, remembering the tools and steps needed to educate our patients effectively. So what are we going to talk about here in the tip of the week this week when we're talking about patient education? We're going to be looking at healthcare goals. We need to understand these very importantly before we can educate our patient. We need to know what we need to educate them about. We're going to look at patient education level, very important to have an understanding of what our patient is able to comprehend when we're giving them information and not speak over their heads. We need to have a good idea of what materials we're going to need to give to the patients or present to them or make available to them. And then we're going to talk about implementation, actually educating the patient. We've gathered a lot of information. You see there's a lot of pre-planning involved, but then we actually will discuss a little bit about implementation. And then more importantly, evaluation and revisiting of that implementation, understanding what the patient actually got from us and how to evaluate that. Finally, I'm just going to talk briefly about ADP or ADPI, and this is one tool that will help you remember the steps involved in preparing a patient education program. Patient care goals. What are we going to be looking at here? Well, patient care goals start off with reviewing the patient care plan. This is in a facility setting. This is very easy. Often, discharge planning is really standardized based upon what the patient has going on, and all of those tools just get gathered together by somebody involved in the discharge plan. Often, there's in larger hospitals, a nurse leader that's involved in the discharge planning along with a social worker, and that information is gathered together for you, the nurse, for that patient, so that there's a lot of the work is done for you. But if that's not the case, or if you're in a smaller facility, you'll need to review the care plan. And ultimately, the patient is your patient, and you have a better understanding of their individual needs at the moment, which may change since the last time the care plan was reviewed. So you may need to adjust and assess that. And of course, that's what you get to do as a nurse. That's part of what we do in the nursing field. You need to interview the patient and caregivers. This goes back to reviewing that care plan, but you should have a good understanding of some of the specific needs of your patient and their caregivers. What do they have available for them? And this includes home resources and assistance. You know, if you have a patient that lives alone, is elderly, has no family members close by, your patient education is going to need to be tailored much differently because they may need additional resources brought to them. You may need to change the way you're going to send this patient home because they are going to need to have other resources or other things brought to them or other assistance provided. This may include community resources. And so part of any care plan, when you send a patient out and are educating them about how to care for themselves, it includes community resources. We talked earlier in the news segment from this episode about dealing with smoking cessation programs and weight gain following quitting smoking. this is all provided for, in a lot of cases, community resources. A lot of health departments have smoking cessation programs, and a part of that includes information on controlling weight gain. So make sure you understand what community resources are available. There may be resources for a lot of things, parenting. There may be resources for people with marriage challenges. You know, if you have a couple that are dealing with major health problems, they may want to go through some marriage strengthening exercises, and those resources are available too. So you really need to understand the total patient, and that's one of the things as nurses we excel at, and I think we should make sure we're using all the resources available to us. What about the patient's educational level understanding, their grade level, a so-called grade level understanding? So often in medical professions, we speak over the patient's head. We use acronyms, we use abbreviations, we use common terminology. We understand, but the patients just stare at you and they nod because they don't want to seem dumb. They think you're going to think they're stupid if they say, "I don't understand what you're saying." We need to avoid that from the very beginning by understanding the patient's education level. We need to tailor our information directly to the patient. And so if we're talking to an elderly patient who has limited understanding, maybe has some cognitive difficulties, or is just because they're elderly, they don't hear very well, we need to tailor our educational material appropriately and our approach appropriately. Consequently, if we have a highly educated, college-educated individual, we may be able to use some so-called big words, but we still should probably shy away from them. And I'll talk a little bit about that here in a second. What about grade level determination? There's a couple of things that you can do. There is the SMOG formula that was put together by G.H. McLaughlin. I have a link in the show notes to this, and you should follow up on that link if you want more information. There's a link in the show notes to the UC, University of California, Davis Hospital page on putting together patient education materials, and it includes a brief look at the SMOG formula, and it basically, just overview, it examines the number of multisyllabic words. So any word, polysyllabic word with three or more syllables, it counts the number of those words in a presentation, and it then uses the presence of those words to tell you what the grade level is that that presentation is going to be understood by. And it seems kind of simplistic, but there's some evidence that this is very effective. And if you're using a lot of big words, you're going to have an expectation that your patient is going to be equipped to understand a lot of big words. So read your information. Go back and think about how you present to patients and use common terminology. If you need to use some slang words because that's what the patient understands, then that's what you need to do. And you just need to kind of understand your patient and your patient community. The big standard I've seen in a couple of different locations is to aim your presentation, your information and materials to the eighth grade level or below for all adults. This means that everybody will pretty much understand it because most adults will have been educated to the so-called eighth grade level, that there's this minimum level of understanding and printed materials and written materials and spoken materials at that level. So that's, if you needed a target, that's your target for adults. If you're educating pediatric patients, grade level's kind of a lot easier because you kind of ask them what grade they're in and aim for the grade they've already completed. Now you may have patients that have some cognitive difficulties and you need to lower the standard appropriately depending on what their cognitive level is. But at least with pediatric patients, you have an actual grade level to deal with. But for adults, aim for eighth grade level materials or below. Remember that all medical knowledge is not equal. A lot of times, and this has happened to me, my father has a lot of health issues, and I'm the person, because of what I do, I'm the person that gets elected by my family to go and talk to a lot of his healthcare professionals. I have to be very careful, because my dad likes to brag on me, I have to be very careful to speak up and say, "I'm sorry, just because I have RN after my name, just because I'm a paramedic, doesn't mean I understand what specific test your specialty is talking about here." And so if just because you have someone that has a certain level of medical knowledge that you're talking to, don't assume they understand what it is you're saying. Again, you can always be safe by dealing with an eighth grade level. And then if they ask you a question that is in medical terminology that is more specific, that helps guide you into a level of their understanding of a specific part of the topic, you can talk to those resources, talk to those terms. But you can always be safe and err on the side of caution, and don't just assume that because someone has some medical knowledge, you know, patients will, you know, their son or daughter might be a CNA, and the parent calls them a nurse, and the son or daughter may not have heard it or may not correct them or may not want to speak up, and you may assume they have a certain level of knowledge and they don't. So again, err on the side of caution. What about materials? Well, there's a lot of things we can provide. Obviously, we should have some kind of handout to give them to take home, and this should be written to the appropriate grade level. A lot of, again, larger facilities have pre-printed handouts to give to the patient with blanks to be filled in for specifics. Make sure that anything written in is written clearly, that you've reviewed it with the patient, and you make sure you point to it and make sure they understand what it says. Because a lot of times, whether it's you or the doctor or whoever, that handwritten stuff can be garbled and misunderstood by the patient quite frequently. If there are online resources that you're going to provide for them, that's great. One of the things I always do when talking to patients is I educate them about reliability of online resources. I like to provide online resources to the patient as part of the materials I give them so that I know I've given them a credible source of information, and they aren't just going to go out there and Google whatever their diagnosis is and take the first thing that pops up. This is dangerous for your patients if they don't understand how to look for credible medical information. Online resources, reliability is key. One of the good places you can always point your patients is NIH Medline Plus Encyclopedia. The National Institutes of Health here in the United States has a great database of information written specifically for patient information. I love it because I can understand it easily, and I know my patients can understand it. It's a great way to review information, and there's just a ton of information about medications, specific illnesses, diagnoses, lab tests, a lot of information there as well. Also, the Mayo Clinic has some good information. So if you're Googling information on a specific diagnosis, if you just include in your Google search Mayo or Mayo Clinic or NIH Medline, it'll bring up those things to the top of the list and help you find those sources first. Audiovisual resources may be available in your facility or your community. Some communities have community access television that is hooked in, and the health department has resources that they put up there. So if you have those resources in your facility, a lot of facilities have in-house channels that patients can go and look at. And if that's the case, you should definitely make use of those resources too. What about implementation? First of all, you need to schedule adequate time. You need to make sure you have enough time to get the job done. Make sure you can educate your patients. If they need to practice or be demonstrated a procedure that they're going to do at home for themselves, or a family member that's there is going to assist them with it, then you need to have enough time to do that procedure with them so that they can demonstrate, or you can show them how to do it properly. Location, location, location. You know, it's not any different than the car dealership down the street. Location, location, location is important. You need to do this in a place that is appropriate to learning. And this means that you're limiting distractions, that you have room for the people that are going to need to be in on the information. You know, if you're in a tiny space and the patient is going to have three primary caregivers and there's not enough room for you, your nursing student, the patient, and their three caregivers, then maybe you can find another place to do this educational piece. So make sure that. Limit distractions and interruptions. If you know that lunch is coming in 15 minutes and you're going to need 20 or 30 minutes to do this patient education piece, you should probably not do it right then, because someone's going to walk in with a tray and interrupt you, and you're going to miss something, you're going to distract from the patient's attention, the caregiver's attention, and you don't want to do that. So plan for interruptions. Make sure you understand. If you have other patients that have other needs and are going to be someone calling you, get someone to cover your area while you go in and do your patient education piece so that other call bell buzzers don't go off and you need to be talking with them. If you have one of those pager phones that you've got to carry around with you and you know you're going to get called every 5 minutes, leave it outside. tell your charge nurse you're not going to be doing it. You're not going to be available for a little bit because you've got to talk to a patient uninterrupted. Let them know where you're going to be and let somebody else have that, and they can come get you if it's a true emergency. Take notes while you are doing the patient education process. It's really important as you go along. If the patient raises a question and you answer it, make note of what that question was so that you can revisit it either with this patient or perhaps add it to the educational process for the next time you do this particular type of education. Finally, evaluate and revisit. And this is where those notes come in handy. It's important. It's also the reason why you need to be uninterrupted and allow for enough time. You need to evaluate whether the patient understood what you're going to do. This prevents errors. It alleviates misunderstandings. A lot of times, a patient will just sit there, and when you ask them, did they understand, they're going to say yes. So you need to find some way to ask them if they understood in such a way that they will have to demonstrate understanding. This means asking open-ended questions, providing them written materials, pointing to the written materials that if there's anything that you didn't understand, I've written down everything I just said, and it's all right here for you to review. Use open-ended questions so that you're not asking them yes or no questions. You're asking them open-ended questions that require them to demonstrate knowledge back to you. And also that if there's a procedure that they have learned, that they demonstrate that procedure. You know, if I've taught someone a procedure before discharge, I often save, you know, if there's a wound dressing change that needs to be done and the patient's going to do it at home, that last wound dressing change, I have the patient do with me. And I have them do it, but I stand there and provide information, knowledge, and education. And that's something you can do as well. So have them demonstrate competence of any procedures back to you before they are discharged or before they leave. Finally, ADPIE, or ADP, I've heard it said both ways, ADPIE. It's a great tool for dealing with care planning in general. It's also a great tool to use when dealing with education of the patient. You can use this tool to prepare educational materials and do the patient education. Assess, diagnose, plan, implement, evaluate. Assess the patient's needs. Look at their goals. Look at what needs to be accomplished. Diagnose what the issues are, what kind of special needs you're going to have for this patient. Plan your educational material. Gather your handouts. Find educational resources that you're going to need. Then implement the education and then evaluate that educational plan. All of that is important, and just wanted to just kind of briefly touch on ADPIE here so that you could also use that as a memory tool to help you with understanding and remembering the steps involved in educating your patients carefully and effectively. I've got some excellent resources linked in the show notes. I urge you to follow up on the show notes over at nursingshow.com for this particular episode. You'll find links for the show notes right at the top of the page, and you'll find the most recent episode listed first. But you definitely want to follow up on the information. I've got some good links there to help you with patient education resources for you and your patients. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to remind everybody that you need to check back in for the show notes for everything discussed in this episode. All of the news items, tip files, and other links mentioned are all available in the show notes for this and every other episode. And you need to follow up on the information because I can provide only general information here. It's your job to follow the links and look at the resources and see how they apply to your own scope of practice. I'll do my job here and get you as much information as I can. It's your job to follow up, make sure that the information gels with what you know and what you're supposed to be doing in your area. I'd like to urge all of you to comment and get back in touch with me here at The Nursing Show. You can reach me, of course, by leaving comments over at nursingshow.com. There are comment links at the bottom or near the top of every single article. You can also reach me by email, comments@nursingshow.com. And you can also get a hold of me over at Facebook, facebook.com/podmedic, or you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/podmedic. Time to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. And we'll wrap up this week with a song from our good friend Matthew Ebel. This is his song, Downtown. If you like what you hear, you'll find more over at MatthewEbel.com, E-B-E-L, M-A-T-T-H-E-W-E-B-E-L.com. And I'll let him know you heard it here on The Nursing Show. There's also a link to purchase his songs over at the iTunes store, and it's a great way to spend 99 cents and show your support for these musical artists that makes their music available here on shows like The Nursing Show. That's it for me. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, reminding all of you, check back next Friday for another episode here of The Nursing Show. And in the meantime, don't forget to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.
Hell, he gives you money, but honey, your daddy don't give a damn unless you got it.